Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. We are confronted at the moment with, rather unexpectedly, I guess, an assault on not just the free world someplace else, but on our own southern border. A woman who has been giving considerable thought to this and writing about it in her inimitable style is our first guest, Diana West, a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio, syndicated columnist, author of two best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana West, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be with you.
You have described what I think of as an invasion taking place now along our southern border, populated in part, but not very largely, by unaccompanied illegal alien children, as a national emergency. Talk about why that is.
I think national emergency is the proper way to face this rather than crisis, because this is an ongoing issue. And it is an emergency issue. Crisis gives us an idea that this is something that will come to an end, that can be stopped, and also that you know, people are taking steps to mitigate it. And this is not the case. This is a national emergency. And what's particularly difficult about it is that our federal government and many state authorities are actually doing things to extend it, entrench it, and perpetuate it.
And to the extent that there is, in fact, a national emergency character to this, it raises a host of questions, not least of which is, what can be done about it? First of all, what is the administration doing for its part? Is it contributing to the problem, or is it, in fact, taking steps that are appropriate to ameliorate it?
Well, any natural reaction by a patriotic presidential administration would immediately take steps to stop the inflow and to deport these aliens back to their nations of origin. That is the natural self-survival instinct at work, but this is not the case at all. And indeed, the Obama administration and all of the ancillary bureaucracies are busy taking steps to make this inflow permanent. They call it temporary steps, but I think we can see that these are steps being made to keep these people here by the 100,000. There is actually a very easy fix, in the sense that the only way that this is happening is because the American people are paying for it. And I think this is where you start getting into sort of layers of the grotesque in terms of understanding what's going on. We are really the means of our own destruction, in the sense that the American taxpayer money is what is fueling every single step of the way. And so what the answer is, the answer lies in the power of the purse, the power of our representatives on Capitol Hill. And this is where we see the big disconnect.
I want to come back to that, Diana, but before we leave entirely the question of the administration's role, would you address a question that a number of members of Congress have been advancing, and others in the punditocracy, of which I consider you to be a charter member, whether the Obama administration, starting with the president himself, bears a considerable degree of responsibility for this invasion because of the policies that it has been pursuing that have served as a kind of magnet for these kids and others. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. But I would question the word policy, because what we're looking at is executive overreach that is not really a policy so much as lawless behavior. I mean, it is lawless to have annulled the congressional wishes on the DREAM Act, for example, and enacted, as President Obama did, in everything but name, through an executive action. I mean, we've seen this and discussed this many times. The president has taken executive actions, dictatorial actions, to create a magnet for this very predicament that's upon us. So yes, the Obama administration and previously the George Bush administration, which did never address the border issue, despite congressional action that called for it to be addressed. This is a long time coming, this problem, and certainly at the top we've seen in both parties actions that have created this national emergency. I mean, this really is a dire predicament. It is a nullification of the border.
And an infringement upon our sovereignty, which we'll also come back to in a minute. But Diana, just then to go to the power of the purse point that you've made, one of the things that I've been struck by is the extent to which we have, it seems now, not only in the bureaucracies of the federal government, agencies that are deeply, deeply invested in this whole idea of processing kids and otherwise facilitating the permanent installation in this country of illegal aliens, but we have a whole slew, many of them faith-based groups that have profited from this enormously. You've done some research into these agencies and these private sector entities. Talk a little bit about this sort of cottage industry, if you will.
Yes, well, it's quite a cottage when you look at the figures here. The faith-based groups, and you know, you could really put quotation marks around faith-based to indicate some degree of skepticism here. We're looking at the U.S. Conference of the Catholic Bishops, the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, the Baptist Child and Family Service. These sound like faith-based groups. They do not have a church. They do not have a congregation. These are essentially entities that are almost entirely funded by taxpayer money. And if just to give you an example, we have the U.S. Catholic bishops, the money that they spent, we have figures for 2012, the money that they spent to assist refugees, 93% of the $71 million that they spent in 2012 to assist refugees is taxpayer money. We get similar numbers looking at the Lutherans. We, you know, way above 96.8% of the total smaller $41 million that they spent in the same year, public money.
So these sort of create a kind of lobby.
Lobby that tells people that they are doing charity work. But charity work is not taxpayer money. That is not taxpayer, that is not charity. There is, it is a real dick to beat people over the head with by claiming this religious act, which is actually just more taxpayer-funded social transfer of wealth. I mean, this is what's going on. But the biggest one that people must become aware of, that I'm aware of, is the Baptist group, Baptist Child and Family Services. This year, they have already received almost $200 million.
This is the group, too, as I recall, that was involved in some rather heavy-handed efforts to suppress medical personnel who were attending to these kids from disclosing the physical condition of many of them, which was rather serious in some cases.
Yes, and they were also the group that was involved in an attempt to buy a $50 million Texas resort to house these people, these aliens. And I have to correct myself. It was actually almost $200 million came to them on one day. They have already received about $250 million this year, but almost $200 million of it came on July 7th, which looks to me like it was the day they were looking to close the deal on the $50 million Texas resort.
Diana, let me close with a perhaps provocative question. I don't know that there's any way to know this, but I wondered what your informed speculation on it might be, and that is that we're seeing this kind of behavior, lawlessness, as you say, on the part of the president. We're seeing the effects of it, creating both situations in which our sovereignty, our border are being eliminated. We're seeing public safety issues develop as a result of these health considerations. Are you concerned that as people, naturally, Americans respond to this with both alarm and, in some cases, a more militant action, that this is being set up as a provocation by the Obama administration for some further effort to crack down on the rest of us?
Well, that's certainly the natural question. I mean, if this wasn't a plan, it certainly is a program at this point. We are seeing these incursions of dangerous people, of disease-ridden people, of overwhelming numbers that communities are unable to support and do not want to support in their midst. The pieces are falling into place for just what you describe. Public unrest, threats to the public safety, all of these become potential excuses for a federal crackdown, for more and more federal involvement and federal laying down the law in ugly ways that are undemocratic and indeed unconstitutional.
We must leave it at that, I'm afraid. Diana West, thank you very much for joining us, as always, for the splendid work you do with your syndicated column. Find it at dianawest.net, and of course for your contributions to Us Each Week. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we'll talk with Father Hannah about the plight of Christians in the Middle East and what it might mean for us as well. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there, America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined for the first time by Father Anthony Hannah. He is the pastor of a parish in Concord, California. It's called St. Mary and St. Mina Coptic Orthodox Church. He is also, among other things, an advisor to the Coptic Pope, Tawadros. And he splits his time between Northern California and Egypt, making three or four trips a year to Egypt, and is therefore extraordinarily well-positioned to talk with us about the plight of Christians, Coptic Christians in Egypt and others in the region, and we're very pleased to have him with us. Father, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us about this extraordinarily important issue.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I say it's an extraordinarily important issue because I believe that the fate that the Christians in the Middle East are experiencing at the moment is kind of a, well, to use the old phrase, canary in a mineshaft moment, where we're witnessing a very historically important population suffering egregiously at the hands of Islamists. Talk a little bit about it, that broader story, if you would, Father, and then we'll get into some of the particulars.
Well, yes, I understand. A Christian in the Middle East is minorities in every country. However, Copts in Egypt, they are the largest minority in Middle East and Africa. Estimated number about 17 to 18 million Copts in Egypt alone. And in other areas, they are all just minority. And now, what we see is happening, and it's happening badly, that the position of United States in the Middle East, now, before, you know, when they had, before what we called the Arab Spring, or what they called it, the Arab Spring is not spring at all, you know, those people have, I mean, the Islamists, they fear America, because they feel if they're going to do something, America may interfere.
We're visiting with Father Anthony Hanna. He is a parish priest in Northern California, the city of Concord, St. Mary and St. Mina Coptic Orthodox Church there, but also an advisor to the Coptic Pope and deeply knowledgeable about events in Egypt as well as in the broader Middle East with respect to the fate of Christian populations. And Father, you were describing that the declining status of the United States and its power is having, as one of the repercussions apparently, the sense taking hold that it's open season for Islamists on Christian minorities in Egypt and beyond. Describe, if you would, just a little bit further, what that connection is between the state of U.S. prestige and power and the plight of these people.
I think this shameful silence of the White House about what's happening in Iraq, and just migrating all the Christians, forced them to leave. And even I was checking the internet last night, and some of even the elderly in a hospital, they could not leave, and they were forced to give up their religion or to be killed, and some of them could not, and end up being converted to Islam, because they cannot do anything, and they are, you know, either elderly or sick or have, like, certain medical conditions. And all this, we hear President Obama just condemning what happened in Gaza between the Palestine and Israel, and he didn't say any word about what's happening in Christians in Baghdad, and I mean in Mosul, in Iraq, or anything. And he didn't say a word. What happened to the Christians in Syria before? Nobody say a word. And then what happened even in Egypt last year? We have 100 churches were burned. We had a very vague statement from one of the State Department people. It was really rather funny because they didn't understand what's going on. In a matter of fact, there is, as I feel like, intentionally done with the media in America to deceive the American people. There is nothing over there, or at least don't talk about it. So people here didn't understand what's going on over there.
Father, let me just ask you to drill down a little bit on what's going on. Start for the moment, if you would, with Egypt. You mentioned churches have been burned. There have also been killings of large numbers of Christians. Christians, as I understand it, were not terribly well treated under the Mubarak regime, but it kind of looked like the good old days relative to how they fared under the Morsi Muslim Brotherhood regime. Things are now under new management, of course, under the new president, al-Sisi. How is the condition of the Christians now compared to what it was under Morsi and company? Are they still suffering at the hands of the Islamists?
Well, you have to understand that it's not only the Christian. The whole country is suffering right now because of the Muslim Brotherhood. And you have to understand that here Obama actually helped them. Well, they give them $8 billion from our tax money just to give up some of Sinai's land to the Hamas, which is the Brotherhood in the Middle East. What do you expect? And now, of course, the whole country is under, you know, in a lot of issues over there. I'm sure you heard about 2 days ago about what happened in a place called El Farafra, when it attacked some part of the army and killed 22 people. And actually, 4 of those people were Christians.
Father Hanna, is the government of Egypt today now taking steps to try to protect Christians against these Islamists?
They are trying, but as I mentioned before in one of the interviews in D.C., that those people are highly, highly and heavily armed. They have a lot of weapons, a lot of updated weapons, a lot of explosive materials, and they attack the army, they attack the police station, they kill the police, they kill the army, and the army is just have no breath to run after them everywhere and every place. You know?
And this is, again, the Muslim Brotherhood that is perpetrating these kinds of atrocities.
Yeah, absolutely. And they announced it, and they're proud of it.
Father, let me turn, if I may, to Iraq. You touched on this a moment ago, but just to make sure we're clear, as I understand it, Christians in Mosul specifically have been very, very badly set upon by this group, the Islamic State, and again, forced to make the sort of choice that you mentioned of either converting to Islam or submitting as sort of dhimmis, as they call them, second class or really enslaved people, or dying. Is that happening to the best of your understanding, and to what effect? Is it resulting in the mass migration of Christians that are losing property and so on? What's the current state of play as you see it?
They even didn't allow him to take anything. Even they had their money or gold or anything, but they're leaving. They have like an inspection point in the area, and they stop them and take everything from them. They said, only you go with the clothes you have on. You cannot, you're not allowed to take anything with you. And all the Christians left had nothing. And even they convert churches to mosques, even burn one of the cathedrals over there. And then last night, even they see like a very old monastery, more than 1,500 years old. They already, took it and converted to a mosque. Just would like to say, if it wasn't for General Sisi in Egypt, if that wasn't happening on June 30th last year, Christians would have been faced the same fate and the same destiny like the Christians in El Mosul. The plan was exactly the same.
Father, this is a terribly, terribly painful story, and I know that our hearts and prayers go out to all of those being afflicted in this fashion. It is a travesty, as you say, that our government has not even expressed its opposition to this kind of conduct, to say nothing of what it did in the Morsi era to facilitate it. I hope that you will come back to us again, Father, with updates on this very important story, because it isn't just about the people in this distant region. It is about how all of us would be treated at the hands of these Islamists. Father, we appreciate your great service. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Anne Corrin joins us. Does the answer to energy insecurity lie with fuel straight ahead?
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. intelligent talk.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Want to know why Israel can no longer tolerate the presence of the terrorist organization Hamas in neighboring Gaza? Consider this fact. The jihadists of Hamasistan have just cut a vital lifeline for the Jewish state's citizens, tourism industry, and other commercial activities. After a single rocket landed a mile away from Israel's principal international airport, the Federal Aviation Administration ordered all U.S. airlines to cease flight operations there. Other airlines say they'll do the same. Neither Israel nor any 21st century nation can allow jihadists to retain the ability to endanger so directly the lives and prosperity of its people in this way. Yet, that would be the practical effect of the immediate ceasefire the Obama administration, the UN, and others want Israel to accept. Memo to Israel, just say no. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined with one of my all-time favorite people. She is Ann Coren, the extraordinarily capable co-director of a remarkable institution in Washington. It is called the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security. It has done pioneering work under her leadership and that of her co-director, Gal Luft, in the space of energy security, how we can actually acquire it and why it is imperative that we do so through an approach she calls fuel choice. And he's also the advisor to the U.S. Energy Security Council, a group of eminent former national security and other government policy practitioners. It is a great force for good, and a credit to Ann and Gal that they've pulled this thing together. They are co-authors of, most recently, Petropoli, The Collapse of America's Energy Security Paradigm. Ann Coren, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always great to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I want to extend congratulations, first and foremost, for your hard work bearing fruit in the form of the introduction of a fuel choice bill in this Congress.
by a friend of this program, Congresswoman Ileana Rose-Laytnan. Talk a little bit about this new legislative initiative and its importance.
Well, this legislation, which is called the Fuel Choice for American Prosperity and Security Act, is aimed at opening the American automobile market to fuel competition. First of all, the reason that this is important is that oil's status as a strategic commodity and OPEC's ability to bring the global economy to its knees by controlling the supply of oil, which it sends to the global market, stems from oil's virtual monopoly over transportation fuel. You know, the U.S. has done amazing work. American entrepreneurs and business people have done amazing work increasing oil production in the U.S., and that's excellent for the local economy, but it doesn't do anything to lower the global price of oil, because OPEC is really in the catbird seat of the global oil market, because it sits on about three-quarters of world conventional oil reserves. What this bill does is it says to automakers, if you open at least half of the vehicles that you produce in a given model year, the fuel competition of some sort, liquid fuel competition, you know, gaseous fuel like CNG, electricity, whatever, you choose the technology, you choose the fuels. If you open your cars to fuel competition, then this will reduce the fuel economy obligation that you face. The U.S. has imposed very high fuel economy standards on automobile manufacturers, increasing to something like 54.5 miles per gallon. This is going to be very difficult and very expensive to achieve. And what the bill does is essentially eases that regulation by giving automakers the option of reducing it by 4 miles per gallon if they open half the vehicles of their fleet to fuel competition.
So fuel competition in a practical sense means what, Ann Corin? Is it sort of plug-in hybrids and other kinds of exotic technologies, or is it something that's closer at hand and perhaps considerably more fuel, well, efficient and affordable?
Definitely closer at hand. You know what? Plug-in hybrids are a wonderful technology and have a lot of promise. They're expensive. And if you look at what's achievable today, because the U.S. has tremendous reserves of natural gas, and natural gas is cheap, we have tremendous reserves of coal. There are lots of political problems using that coal, but we do have a lot of coal. It's very simple, and in fact, this is what China's been doing, to make fuel from the coal and to certainly make that same fuel from natural gas. The fuel is called methanol. It's a fuel that's very similar to ethanol in that it's alcohol, but tremendously economic because it's made from resources like natural gas or from coal. It's much cheaper than gasoline on a per mile basis. And so if you look at a car that can use this fuel, you're looking at a flex fuel vehicle that is a gasoline, ethanol, methanol flex fuel vehicle. It looks and performs exactly like a regular car. It costs automakers less than $100 extra to make as compared to a gasoline-only car. And it lets the consumer choose, do I want to put gasoline in my car? Do I want to put methanol made from natural gas or from coal in my car? Do I even want to put ethanol in my car? I get to choose depending on the price. And that opens your market to competition.
And it could very substantially erode the kind of dominant, monopolistic position that the OPEC cartel has enjoyed all these years. Ann Corin, one of the raps on methanol that I've heard, and I'd like to just get you to address it, is that it is highly corrosive. And putting it into our fuel infrastructure and automobiles would be very detrimental to their long life capability. What's your response to that point?
Well, first of all, alcohol is corrosive. Ethanol is more corrosive than gasoline, and methanol is more corrosive than ethanol. That's why you want a flex fuel vehicle, which is a vehicle that has materials in the fuel line and other parts that touch the fuel that are high grade enough to withstand the more corrosive impact of alcohol. And material cost is very, very low. That's why the added cost of a flex fuel vehicle that can run on up to 85% methanol or 85% ethanol and gasoline costs just $100 more than a regular car. If you're looking at a car that's gasoline only, you know, you don't want to put very much alcohol in it. You can probably put 15%, maybe a little bit more in a new car and it'll be fine. But if you want to be able to choose whatever fuel makes economic sense for you at the moment, if you want to be able to choose to purchase that, then you really want a flex fuel vehicle that is warranted to use gasoline, ethanol, and methanol. When an automaker warranties a car, they're warranting it to work 100% of the time on the fuel that you purchase. That's why legislation like this is so very, very important.
I've been told that in China, where, as you say, the Chinese are making a very serious effort to use their considerable coal reserves to produce fuel so that they can reduce the amount of oil or, for that matter, natural gas that they have to import from elsewhere. But that because many of the cars in the Chinese fleet at the moment, at least, are of American manufacture, that American car manufacturers have actually warrantied the cars to run on methanol as well. Is that the case, Anne?
Well, what you're seeing, basically, yes. What you're seeing is effectively, you know, the Chinese market, because it's so large and growing at such a rapid clip, is a much more important market for automobile manufacturers such as GM and so forth than the U.S. market, which is a mature market already. And in China, methanol use is spreading very rapidly because the fuel is really cheap as compared to gasoline. It's not subsidized. It's just cheaper because it's made from coal, which is much cheaper than oil. And so you have a rampant, really illegal fuel blending in addition to the blending that's going on normally and legally and disclosed. And so de facto, car makers that want to sell cars in China need to be able to handle the fuel. That's what's going on there now.
Got it. Well, it's a very auspicious development if they will do the same for us here, because as you say, and Corin, in Petropoli and in your other great writings, including Turning Oil into Salt, that we have an opportunity using existing technology in this country to give consumers fuel choice. And let's close just with the observation that this may not simply be something desirable. It may be absolutely necessary that we diversify our transportation fuels in light of instability in so many countries where oil is currently being produced. Talk a little bit about that as you see it at the moment as an impetus for Ross Lehtinen's bill.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at the OPEC countries that sit on 3/4 of world conventional reserves, you're looking at a set of countries that are probably, other than North Korea, the worst actors in the world. I mean, you're looking at Iran, you're looking at Saudi Arabia, you're looking at all sorts of countries that are really problematic.
Well, Iraq at the moment, you've got Nigeria, you've got Syria in a small way, Venezuela. I mean, really, it's a who's who of countries that are either despotic or at least unstable in the extreme.
Exactly. Places you would not want to go on vacation, you know. So definitely not stable places for oil production if you're looking at the mid and long term, and places where radical Islamists are just gaining a foothold every single day, whether they are Sunni or Shia, depending on the country. And to entrust the global economy by entrusting the global transportation fuel market to one fuel that's dominated by a cartel that's based in these countries is a very dangerous thing to do.
It's insane. It's what dangerous is only part of it. It is downright insane. And Corin, your work at the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security is incredibly valued and an impetus behind this very promising new avenue for fuel and energy security. And I salute you for it. Congratulations, as always, for the work you're doing, most especially the introduction of the Ross Lehtinen bill. We hope there will be a companion in the Senate and they will be adopted and enacted into law this year. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, George O'Connor will be talking about China and cyber war against the United States. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At America'sMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families,
including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined once again, I'm very pleased to say, by George O'Connor, the chairman and CEO of Chime Media, a company that specializes in big data management and analytics, a guy that we turn to when matters involving the digital world arise, and they do with some regularity these days, because it turns out there are people who are
skilled at and very actively engaged in exploiting our dependence on that digital world to our detriment, shall we say, including communist China. George, welcome. I'm delighted to have you with us and very anxious to talk a little bit about the Chinese.
Frank, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
One of the things that has arisen of late, including in the form of federal prosecutions by the United States government against mostly absent Chinese operatives, it seems, is the extent of communist China's efforts to penetrate our computer systems for the purposes of, at minimum, stealing what's on them, including very sensitive proprietary information and indeed national security secrets, and perhaps taking control of them. Talk a little bit about the state of the art as you see it vis-a-vis China.
Well, the state of the art, I think, goes back 10 or 12 years to hardware that was shipped in the United States by Chinese companies that was disguised as networking hardware. And these big computer switches were shipped into major government facilities in the United States, research facilities, think tanks, corporations, and they were really ripoffs of companies like Cisco's switching gear. And what it was designed to do is send copies of things, as soon as it saw a way out through a network, back to Chinese data centers and corporations. And so this has really been going on for quite a long time. Some of China's military developments look exactly like U.S. military developments, like our new fighter bomber, down to the millimeter. In some cases, the parts are exactly the same size, so that's not hard to figure out. The massive investment we make in private corporations and military development procurement, what's happening is China is able to sidestep that expense, and the expense is the time and the money to develop those things, and then pick and choose what they're going to develop themselves using these blueprints. It's like getting a blueprint for free. And then, as I think you're alluding to, the insider knowledge of how these things operate, they've got all this time to examine potential vulnerabilities.
So it's an opportunity to both avoid the kind of costs that the U.S. taxpayer has to bear to bring these weapon systems, like the F-35, for example, online. But, George O'Connor, it also affords them possibly opportunities to counter the military effectiveness of such systems because they know, as you say, their internals, their vulnerabilities to be exploited.
For sure. And it's a broad range of intellectual property and business data theft that goes from very specific military systems like that fighter through to, you know, proprietary designs. I think we just charged 5 PLA officers about a month and a half ago with theft of intellectual property from corporations to what's actually happening inside those corporations and the ability to manipulate financial markets to their advantage. And it's a very canny strategy, and it went from, you know, there was a couple of Chinese executives who were arrested and deported who were stealing seeds from a Monsanto field just recently. And so you got that kind of physical thing happening, but then this hardware which has been shipped into the country, and it's really an international problem, but we're the biggest target and you need to be most concerned, I think, about our own national interests. And then all this hacking conversation, and now just in the last couple weeks, a security firm found that the barcode scanners that were being shipped from a Chinese company were infected. So when they would use the barcode scanner, it would infect the rest of the system it was attached to and then send all the information about that company back to some Chinese source.
This is a comprehensive, systematic, as you say, long-term effort by communist China to wage what I can only think of as a sort of economic war. It's also obviously cyber espionage as well. And yet we keep hearing the U.S. government and the Obama administration talking about somehow they're going to cooperate with the Chinese on this whole cyber threat spectrum. And George, I was struck by something. I think the Wall Street Journal reported recently that the Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary Liu, actually claimed that, quote, China is committed to vigorously prosecuting trade secret theft cases, unquote. George, in Chime Media and in your other capacities, see any evidence that the Chinese are actually, other than the perpetrators of this kind of trade secret theft?
Well, of course they're the perpetrators. And the evidence is overwhelming that they employ this exact strategy of an attack. And when they're caught, they become immediately outraged and put up a surface, a show that they're shocked, absolutely shocked that this could possibly have ever happened. And they make a lot of noise about getting into action about solving the problem. And what it allows them to do is reap the benefits of their, you know, violations of international law, okay, for sure, and our laws. And then they get a nice long 5 to 10 year window to cover it all up so they never really pay a penalty for it.
And we actually see the United States government tending to give them the benefit of the doubt, in some cases at least, and I guess sort of giving them a pass on retaliatory steps.
Of course, but it's like a child having a discussion with a parent, somebody else's parent of 10 children who's now in their 50s, and the 6-year-old thinking that they're having the same conversations. And I hate to be so pejorative, because I really want to support our government, but the short-term thinking of this quarter and this year, it's a totally different conversation than dealing with China, who is making very, very smart long-term plans for themselves.
75 years is the short term for them, I think. Listen, we're almost out of time, George. Let me quickly turn to one other issue. And in that very spirit of short-term, sort of quarter-by-quarter focus on our part and long-term thinking on theirs, talk a little bit about the planned initial public offering of an internet giant in China called Alibaba. What concerns do you have about it?
Well, it's a very, very well-run sort of a monster of an internet company. I think that we have to be aware of how it was created and the conditions under which it was founded to grow to this size. The economic power and information power it has as it moves out into public markets with that kind of leverage is a little bit like the horse has already left the barn, because it was created in this incubated, tax-incented haven. Okay, that's done. They're now coming out as a public company, but they're going to have, as a corporation, all of the sort of private information that we expect to stay private when we deal with other companies. Maybe an Amazon is better at it than a Google, but Alibaba is really another step beyond Google, where you can just assume that somebody else is looking at your purchase histories, your economic information.
And that may mean the People's Republic of China, not simply the company or its staff. George, I'm afraid we're out of time for today, but I hope that we'll have you back soon to visit further about this, because my guess is this is a transaction that on many different levels, in terms of the investment risks on the one hand, in terms of the security of information, both personal and proprietary information, that we're going to find reason to be very concerned about Alibaba and indeed what the Chinese overlords who run it are up to. Thanks so much for your work at Chime Media. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. And I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure.